It's a good day my son doesn't poop in his underwear. All right.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Business and Labor Committee to order here and convene on this Monday, April 6th. We have a few public hearings this morning, committee, and with that, I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3501.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure revises the voting requirements for certain actions related to the formation or conversion of benefit companies. There are no amendments before you.
Thank you. Representative Hack, would you like to bring anyone up with you?
I would, if that's okay. I have a couple.
Depends on who.
Oh, my.
No. He didn't hear it. He didn't hear it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and get us started for this week.
Okay. Chair Holby and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jody Hack. I am the representative for House District 19, which includes parts of South Salem, Almsville, and Turner. I am here on behalf of House Bill 3501, which would change the shareholder majority vote requirements placed upon benefit companies from a two-thirds to a simple majority. What are benefit companies? Benefit companies take into account their environmental and social impact while making business decisions rather than merely focusing on earning a profit. Members of the committee, we need more companies who care about the earth and work to enrich their communities. This bill would increase the opportunities for small, publicly owned companies to become benefit companies due to the altered shareholder majority vote requirement. This bill would also make it easier to increase the amount of benefit companies in Oregon. Chair Holby, members of the committee, I implore you to support this bill while you keep in mind the positive impact that it will have on Oregon's business development and investment, along with the social and environmental effects these companies promote. Thank you for your time and consideration. And Jim Bruneau knows much, much more about this than I do. And I do have a committee here in a little bit, but I'll hang around for as long as I can. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Good morning, Jim. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Jody. My name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder and CEO of Willamette Valley Vineyards, just located south of Salem. We're one of the smallest publicly held companies of our kind in the United States. And in the original drafting of this legislation, I don't think there was consideration, and certainly I didn't offer any information when at the time it was originally passed, about the voting requirement of the bill. Small publicly held companies struggle to get even a quorum of those entitled to vote on their proxy ballots. And the reason for that is because we're very small, and often our shareholdings are very diverse and widely held. And the increments are very small amounts. Most publicly held companies are much larger, and they have shareholdings that are much larger increments that are held by financial institutions and the like. But for us, our financial institutions that hold our company are less than, I think, 2% of our shareholdings. And so when we do a proxy ballot vote, we struggle just to get the number, just to get 50% of those entitled to vote annually. So this requirement means that not only do we have to get 66% of the vote, every person that votes has to vote in favor. So it's a very, very high bar. And all we're asking is that you apply the provisions of the law that you apply to other companies to us due to our size.
Thank you, Ms. Short. Representative Evans, a question?
Yes. Mr. Bruneau, I'm kind of a simple guy. I just want to make sure. If we pass this, this will help your business grow and sell more wine overseas. Good job.
We conduct ourselves in a way that makes us attractive to a number of consumers that consume our product. This legislation that was originally passed and this certification status helps communicate that message. And we're appreciative the Oregon legislature has created such a model for us. We just want to make sure that we can be part of the club.
Thank you. I know for the record, I think that was a yes. I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Representative Doherty.
So, in other words, because of the voting, the way it currently is, that it would be very difficult for your company to be a benefit company because of the voting requirement?
Yeah, absolutely. Almost impossible.
Okay, thank you very much.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, Mr. Bruneau, I don't mean to torpedo your bill, but is it true that were you Representative Gomberg's best man, or was it vice versa? I heard.
I wouldn't answer that.
I think that's a
very
fair question.
Germaneness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what you may not know is that Representative Gomberg helped me clear the land to plant the vines back in 1983.
And some fine vines they are. Any other questions? Not seeing any. I appreciate you bringing the bill forward and also, you know, making it so it does just address the smaller B Corps. I think that makes it very palatable. So thank you very much for your testimony today, and enjoy the rest of your week.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
With that, was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3501? Not seeing any, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3501 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3487.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires licensed investigators to include their name and their license number on all advertisements. There are no amendments.
Thank you. Representative Huffman, good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Committee members, John Huffman, House Representative for District 59. And I just want everybody to know I have a new respect for Representative Gomberg after the previous testimony. We now know he actually got dirt under his fingernails, and he's done more than fly kites. House Bill 3487 truly is a simple bill. The private investigators came under DPSST back around 2005, 2007, somewhere in that neighborhood. And when they went from their independent association under the DPSST umbrella, there was a statute created, 703.450, that brought them under DPSST. When that statute was rewritten to reflect DPSST, this little portion was inadvertently left out, which is similar to construction contractors in that private investigators shall include in all advertisements for investigator services their name and their license number for investigation. That is all the bill does. And I believe Eric Gablix, the director of DPSST, submitted some testimony talking about they're very well aware of this, and they've known basically for the last 10 years that this little piece was dropped out, and they were just waiting to find a sympathetic legislator to drop a bill for them and get this back in the record as something that they would need to do. And we've got Ronald Miller and Jim Gibson, also private investigators, and they either are or have been on the board of the committee for private investigators under DPSST, and they've got some testimony also. That's it.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Huffman? Looks like you're out of here early.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at
really.
All.
Such a good job.
Thank you.
So, thank you very much. Let's have up Ronald Miller, Jim Gibson, and Eric Gablix. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Ron Miller. I'm a licensed investigator in Oregon. I sit on the board of directors for the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators, the primary professional organization in the state. And that is the capacity with whom for whom I'm testifying here today. I'm also seated on the DPSST Private Security Investigators Policy Committee. But that's just an aside.
So go ahead and give us
this
tell us about the bill.
As Representative Huffman stated, this is just a cleanup bill. It just restores the original language in the statute. that it may seem like a little piece, but it is very important because, quite frankly, we have gone through great efforts to professionalize the investigative industry in this state and have made great gains for that. But it's an industry that attracts a lot of squirrels, okay? And thanks to Craigslist and other social media, there are a number of folks that DPSST can attest to that we've reported to them who are practicing unlicensed, many of whom undoubtedly have serious criminal history records and other problems. It's a consumer protection issue. And there are even out-of-state investigators that are advertising online, social media, as far as the East Coast to provide investigative services in Oregon. And this additional language makes it very clear and it is very easily enforced by DPSST. Either your name and license number is there or it's not. And it will simplify things for them and it will also provide the appropriate information for the consumer to make sure that they're getting somebody who has met the statutory requirements for the profession.
Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, I'm Chair Hovey and committee members. I'm Jim Gibson. I'm a licensed private investigator out of Clatskanie. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 3487 that amends ORS 703450 to add back that requirement that licensed investigators have their name and license number in any advertisement. That information is critical for aiding the public in knowing that people that they're doing business with are licensed investigators in the state of Oregon. Without the name and or license number, the public is unable to determine whether the person is licensed or not. DPSST maintains the database for all licensed investigators in the state of Oregon. That database is searchable by name and license number, which ties in with the public being able to, because that is public accessible. Having that requirement will also aid DPSST in identifying people that are out there, as Craigslist, Facebook, you name it, that are trying to get business generated that don't have a license. Oregon is probably one of the best when it comes to investigating. I'm past president and past membership director for the Oregon Association of Licensed Investigators. I'm also one of the two, along with Ron. I'm serving my second term at DPSST on the Private Security, Private Investigator Policy Committee. And we're in the process of changing that to add a subcommittee just for private investigators so that we can review cases of unlicensed if DPSST feels that they need to be reviewed by the subcommittee. I've been a licensed private investigator for about 7 years, and prior to that, I worked in law enforcement, 27-year career in Columbia County, and 3 years as a reserve deputy prior to that. I'm also a appointed member of our local public safety coordinating committee in Columbia County. Been doing that for almost a year. Also an elected representative for the Clatskanie Rural Fire Protection District and our Clatskanie Library District. And I bring that up as my point that I'm deeply concerned about our communities and our citizens. And I see this legislation as putting that key piece in there for the public to be assured when they're dealing with somebody that they're a licensed and not a rogue investigator out there doing things illegally. I believe that it's critical to get that language back in, and I believe it's a real simple fix, and I urge you to please support HB 3487. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Eric Skablix. I'm the director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, more often known as DPSST. I'll just make my comments very quick. We appreciate Representative Huffman's introduction of 3487. As many of you know, DPSST serves 41,000 constituents, mostly in uniform, police officers, corrections officers, 911 operators, firefighters, but we're also very pleased to work with the private investigator industry. A small group, but an important group, and they came to us over a decade ago when a standalone state agency was no longer able to be funded, which was the Oregon Board of Investigators. They reached out and looked for a new home, and DPSST became that home, and we've been proud of the partnership we've had with both Jim and Ron and their predecessors on the advisory committee. What's somewhat unique is that we actually do have the industry helping to set the standards that regulate the work that they do and the people who provide that work. This issue has come up in the past, and it's really a consumer protection issue, which is when people hire a private investigator, they want to ensure that they meet the same standards that everybody else does. And through the use of social media, we do have people easily posting their shingles online, and people don't know who they are, and more important, if they're licensed. And this bill would give us not only an enforcement arm, but also an education arm to address these issues and make sure everybody providing private investigator services in the state of Oregon is not only meeting the standard, but also playing by the same set of rules. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions from the committee. So in not seeing any, in looking at the bill, I was sort of curious. I don't see it in here. I don't know if it exists. But is there a requirement that your name and license number be included in any contract or when you're actually employing or taking on a case? Because I don't see that requirement in the legislation, not just this bill, that you actually have to provide your license number to your client.
Actually, there is a provision that if the client requests, we are required to provide them with a written contract that spells out what the services are.
I understand that, but if the client doesn't request, and even if the client does request, I don't see a requirement that your license be in the contract. That's my issue. And it seems like that would be an additional consumer protection piece in this statute, though not, I don't know, just my point of view, I guess. I don't know. Is it required anywhere else that you know of?
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm not aware of that. What we really have done is on the back end through the enforcement, when people do hire private investigators or private security officers, we do obviously do quite a bit of education about who are you hiring to make sure they meet those standards. But then there's also the enforcement pieces when people do provide private investigator work and we find out that they are not licensed. Then we obviously work with education first, but then there is an enforcement arm where we can level a civil penalty against that provider.
Yeah, appreciate that. I guess, from my experience, when we enter into contracts like with construction contractors and other contractors, they're required to have their license number and name in the contract, and it be provided up front to the consumer as an effective method of consumer protection as well. I just think that would be a good addition to this bill
I'm thinking that that's a piece that we might be able to write into the administrative rules, because we're in the middle of rewriting a lot of the administrative rules and make it a requirement through the DPSST administrative rules.
And I'll check, but Chair Holby, I don't know, would you be opposed if that's an amendment to that?
Mr. Chair and committee, the people we represent would undoubtedly have no objection to a dad. In fact, when I read the statute as proposed, that I asked the same question. As a matter of practice, I would say that certainly all the professional investigators that I deal with do include that information on their contracts, but we would not object at all to adding that language.
Yeah,
to,
and I would suspect all the licensed legitimate ones do that.
Yes, but they're not our.
This is
not
about
the
consumer protection piece, for other investigators that may not be licensed that are out there, that it would certainly be another violation if they entered into a contract without a license, obviously. But I think that disclosure is important for consumers to know.
So just
a thought. I think we have time if there's no objection to slide something like that in here. Representative Huffman, did you want to comment about that?
Th-
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Huffman, again, good catch. And I guess my question is, I think we're all amenable, so would you like me to have an amendment drafted? I can probably just add in line 15 and in all contracts something that I think would be pretty simple. Would you like me to have that draft and bring
well,
back? Jan, would you?
The relating clause is relating to advertisements.
Never mind. we'll have the committee administrator look into it. It may be that the relating to clause, as my committee administrator just pointed out, may be too narrow to accomplish this.
Jan and I can communicate back
so,
and forth.
Well, just for future thought, maybe. This bill may not be
very
the right vehicle for that. Mm-hmm. So sorry to take you down that road, but it certainly answered my question and did point out something I'd like to see in the future anyway, if we don't get it in this bill. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for bringing this forward. I think it's a good bill. So
it's a good start anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3487? Not seeing any, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3487. Stand at ease for just a couple minutes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you just fine. Can you hear us okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Business and Labor and open a public hearing on House Bill 3162. And Jan, would you give us just a brief
I will, Mr.
Review.
Chair, committee members. The measure as written establishes a task force on franchisees that would study the relationship among franchisers, sub-franchisers, and franchisees to determine whether the franchisee is the employee of the franchisor for purposes of applying state laws and other laws. However, there is a proposed -2 amendment that replaces the original measure, and it establishes requirements for the sale of a franchise in Oregon, prohibits certain restrictions in a franchise agreement, and establishes rights of franchisees to sell, to assign, or to transfer a franchise. And it requires a franchisor to purchase specified current inventory if the franchise is not renewed in accordance with the provisions of the Act. That's it.
Thank you. And good morning, Representative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. And thank you for hearing this bill today. As a preliminary issue for the original bill, that's to just study the relationship between employees and independent contractors. That's not at all the focus of this bill. That was just a placeholder text, as many of us, I think, understand. You just sometimes have the idea for a broad relating to clause. So the real focus of this bill came out of a conversation that I had with a constituent who's here with me today but does not want to testify. Her name is Janelle Bynum, and she's a second-generation McDonald's franchisee owner. And it was in the context of some of the stuff that we're working on this session, paid sick leave, raising the minimum wage, et cetera. And she helped me to really understand the unique position that franchisees are in because, you know, often in franchisee agreements, not necessarily hers, but in other ones, they don't have a lot of control over anything but wages. And so when we do things like raising the minimum wage and instituting paid sick days, it often puts some of those franchise owners in a bit of a pinch because the only way they can really, you know, have any margin, they can't shift costs a lot because a lot of their operating issues are kind of already controlled. So I thought she made a very excellent point, and I really appreciated that perspective. And so I got to thinking, because I do tend to support those movements for workers, that my staff and I sort of looking into if there's any other states that are kind of pushing back on, you know, instead of only pushing down on wages, pushing up on kind of the corporate franchisor and looking at that relationship. And that's where we discovered that there's kind of some movement to look at starting to create a franchisee bill of rights in other areas to kind of establish some basic minimums that Oregon small business owners get to enjoy in their franchise. franchise agreement, because franchise agreements are all over the place. Ms. Bynum has told me about some, you know, some great opportunities that McDonald's offers in their franchise agreement. I heard after this bill was dropped from a Sport Clips owner who said that, you know, their franchisor is wonderful and does some really great work, and that's great. So this franchise Bill of Rights takes a lot of what's in the best franchise agreements and kind of puts them into a Bill of Rights for Oregon small businesses that says to kind of the large or out-of-state corporations, the Marriotts, the other franchisors, that if you're going to, you know, open us, you know, if you're going to sell a franchise in Oregon, that these are kind of some basic protections that our Oregon small business owners deserve. The franchising model is an interesting one, and really one that has given a lot of people, particularly a lot of first-time entrepreneurs, an opportunity to own a business that they may have never otherwise had. Now, the premise is simple. Somebody comes up for an idea for a product or service. They invest in it, they make it, and they realize that it's kind of easily able to be easily replicated. And so they start to look to getting investors. And except in this situation, investors don't just invest money, but they also actually buy into the business and run the little businesses themselves as franchisees. And the person who comes up with the idea, you know, actually just sells kind of their process, and then the small business owner gets to actually implement it and do it their way. Franchises are a wonderful opportunity and really can work well for everyone involved. Like I said, many of them are first-time entrepreneurs that have an opportunity to benefit from a tested product and the strategies of a large chain. They can also realize many economies of scale by being able to purchase supplies in bulk and spread the cost of shared expenses. At the same time, these small business owners, the individual franchisees, are more responsive to their local communities than are obviously the large kind of distant corporations, the franchisors. But increasingly, the relationship is sometimes fraught with inequality. We're starting to see a lot more franchisors just writing very imbalanced contracts that squeeze individual franchisees at every turn. Today, there's stories about franchisors earning high profits as many of their franchisees are struggling to get by or even going out of business. These franchisees pay for the use of their brand. They start with an upfront fee location. They also pay for the cost of constructing and equipping the businesses. And then franchisees typically pay a fixed percentage of their revenues, not of their profits, but of their overall revenues every month, and often have to buy most of their suppliers through the franchisor. And what that means is they often have little control over how much they can afford to pay their workers. As one economist put it, if the corporation sets everything but wages, they set the wages, because if every other kind of cost containment measure in a business is already controlled, then it kind of affects their ability to pay wages. So this, to me, is an opportunity to really, obviously, you know, advancing kind of the working families issues that I care about, but in a way that we can actually protect Oregon small businesses. And the balance of power between these franchisors and franchisees is never going to be equal on its own. The reality is that you have these large corporations with entire departments and teams, and then you have Oregon small business owners, and particularly, you know, maybe they just own one or two stores or one or two locations. So this is an idea that is not new to Oregon. There's other states looking at other similar issues. There's actually, at this point, there's a Dash 2 amendment that I've worked on with Josh Brown, who's the attorney on the phone. How I came across him is, I don't know, some of you know, I'm an obsessive podcast listener. Obsessive with a capital O. I'm listening to them pretty much all the time, every time. And I was listening to a separate legal marketing podcast, and he was on there talking about how he's niched down, and his website is literally Indie Franchise Lawyer. So all he does is really this franchise law. So I reached out to him about this bill. We had a great conversation, and he really is going to be able to bring a perspective because he's seen so many different franchise agreements and stories. In the Dash 2, I just want to point out a couple of the ideas that we're coming up with here. And I want to make one important point, and there's a provision on in sub 6 that says slightly something different, so that's going to be changed. Nothing in here would be intended to void a franchisee or void a franchise agreement. It would simply replace provisions that are in that contract if they don't meet the minimum standards in Oregon, or imply certain terms into the contract if those terms are not expressly in the contract. But even a contract that did not have all of these requirements would not be a void contract. Just that provision would be replaced by the standard that we have for Oregonians. So just quickly, permitting a franchisee to rescind end a franchise agreement with a term of 10 years or more within 3 days after executing the franchise agreement. In a lot of areas of Oregon law, we have kind of that buyer's remorse protection. A lot of these franchise agreements are 10 to 20 years long, and allowing there to be some kind of moment where after somebody signs, where they have a short period of time in which they can rescind without any penalties is important. Making sure that the franchisee can renew the franchise under terms that are free from unreasonable costs, fees, or stipulations. Again, when people invest in these franchises, they pour their entire lives into these small businesses, and making sure that when that contract does come up, that those renewals will be somewhat automatic, you know, and that they're not going to be charged a whole bunch of extra fees in order to keep their business running. Making sure that the franchisor has to provide the franchisee with reasonable written notice of significant changes to the operation. And there's some instances, and Mr. Brown will speak more to this, where, you know, somebody buys into a franchise, and again, because these are large corporations versus small business owners, you often have, you know, terms in there that really are weighted towards the corporation. And then the franchisor will change significantly the business model or change their brand significantly, and yet this franchisee is locked in for 10 or 20 years. So creating a provision where if there's a significant change to the business that the franchisee can actually get out without paying a penalty or liquidated damages. Require a franchisor, before terminating a franchise, to have good cause and to give the franchisee a detailed reasons for the termination and to identify provisions of the contract that the franchisee breached, and most importantly, to allow them a reasonable opportunity to cure the breach. Because, again, these are small business owners who pour their lives and most of their savings into these businesses. If a franchisor or sub-franchisor terminates a franchise, they can't compel the franchisee to pay liquidated damages or early termination fees. You may look at this and think, oh, that's obvious. But again, in these contracts, the courts will typically, in most cases, if the parties have contracted to that, will enforce it. And with these, you know, extreme imbalance of power, there's franchise agreements where it'll actually say that even if the franchisor terminates the agreement, the franchisee has to pay penalties because there's no provision saying that they can't do that. Not all of them, of course. Again, these are taking kind of the best of franchise agreements and putting them into a standard for Oregon. So I could go on, but I'm going to leave some time for Mr. Brown to kind of talk some specific stories. One other one I wanted to point out is on the final page, sub C. And again, this is one that Mr. Brown made me aware of. A court may not award attorney's fees solely to the failing defendant or the prevailing plaintiff. There's some franchise agreements where, let's say, you know, Marriott, and I'm just throwing that out there, I don't have any specific information about them, but if you go into litigation with them, it may say in your franchise agreement that if they win, you have to pay their attorney's fees. But if you win, they don't have to pay your fees. And so making sure that if there's fee shifting, that only goes one way. Because, again, unlike, you know, in an employee-employer relationship where the law requires standards, these are not those kind of relationships. These are arm's-length contract negotiations, and the courts will pretty much enforce what's there. And so this is a way to kind of provide that minimum standard for Oregon small businesses to make sure that they can compete on a level playing field. And finally, I saw that the International Franchise Association has some opposition testimony saying that this will further confuse or make it difficult for small businesses. And I strongly disagree with that, and they'll obviously have their opportunity to make their case. But these franchise agreements are large and complicated. This simply provides a basic level of a basic standard that we can protect our Oregon small businesses. And so I think this is a great bill. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Mr. Brown. Or do you want to ask me a question? Okay.
Can I ask a quick question? Yeah. May I, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
I can talk to her later if you prefer.
No, go ahead.
About the fee shifting provision, which caught my attention, a question is, I would think, and I'm totally guessing, that most of these have a venue provision. For example, a McDonald's franchisor is probably subject to Illinois law only, and any litigation must be doing such that whether we pass this law or not, it's not going to make a difference because these aren't really Oregon law contracts. Am I right on that? Or is there
You are, but actually this addresses that. So there's a provision in here that actually says both for a forum selection clause and for a choice of law provision that those would be in Oregon. Because, again, you have Oregon small business owners, you know, and all of a sudden if they get in a dispute with their franchisor, they have to go compete with, you know, under Delaware law and go fly to Delaware. And so this actually would, again, as part of that Bill of Rights, would say that, no, if you franchise with an Oregon small business, that the forum is Oregon and the choice of law is Oregon, and it voids any provisions that state otherwise in their contract.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
Can we do that? I really don't know. That's an honest question. Can we? Could we do that? Is that enforceable?
We're going to find out.
Legislative Council did not have any concerns about, and I specifically requested that provision, so they didn't have any concerns about it, but certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Noth.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, which is I've always heard that, you know, small business franchisers, McDonald's, Taco Bell's, they always get pinched, right? And this is the first time I've ever had someone explain to me how it works. I wish, it should be a requirement that we all have to take contract law, because I feel like this is going over my head a little bit, but I feel like you're really on to something that's fascinating. So I'm just keep. It's,
you have a question?
No, not yet. It's really interesting how if you don't understand contract law, you're at a loss to figure this out.
Are there any other questions?
Not anybody.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fagan, thanks for bringing this bill forward. Understand what you're trying to do. I've actually been in some of these contracts and everything, and we actually stipulate when we negotiate a contract with somebody, when we're manufacturing for them or we're buying from them, we'll stipulate we want it in Oregon or the state they're in for that. But looking at some of the other stuff, how is the franchisor to keep control of the quality of the product if you were to let a franchisee just kind of go and do their own thing because they felt something was better? So if I went into McDonald's and I got a chicken sandwich in California or even in Oregon, one franchise might be buying everything through the system, another one might decide, you know what, I like this chicken over here better, so I'm going to go buy it because I can get it cheaper. How do you control that if you allow franchises to just kind of go do their own thing and not really follow the business model that's put in place for the quality control for customer assurance all the time? That's a big concern that I have, because the whole idea behind a franchise is, me, I would take part in a franchise so I could basically have them go out, market it, push everything for me. All I have to do is make sure I have people there to make sure things are being served. Or it depends upon the type of franchise it is. There's tons of different models out there. So I'm just wondering how you see that as a positive with someone being able to do that. So one McDonald's is buying their chicken from someplace else. And let's just say they buy bad chicken and the customers get salmonella. That affects the whole corporate brand at that point because they were trying to save money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, there's nothing in this bill that, in fact, I think, I'm certain that the very nature of a franchisor-franchisee relationship is there is a modicum of control that the franchisor has to kind of maintain the brand. There's nothing in here that would allow, in fact, I was trying to find it, but it's such a long bill, I couldn't find the exact provision, but there's a provision in here that requires them to allow the franchisor to buy, you know, products from elsewhere, but it actually indicates that only if it's at the standard, that it kind of meets the standard of the franchisor. So again, you couldn't, for a, you know, Pizza Hut, you couldn't go buy, like, you know, pepperoni that wasn't up to standard or containers or whatever. So that's still absolutely in here. In fact, that's an absolutely critical part of being a franchisor or franchisee, is there is that element of control so they can preserve their brand. There's nothing in here that disallows them to have that ability to set uniform standards. The question then is, and I actually believe that McDonald's is one that the franchisees will actually purchase together through a place that's not McDonald's, but it's a certain standard of, like, certain certain foods, and McDonald's has kind of approved that standard, so the franchisees can kind of band together, buy in bulk, in a sense, so that their cost per unit is low, and that's a good practice. That's not the case in every franchise agreement. Some franchisees are not allowed to buy from anyone except the franchisor. So they could never actually, you know, try and cost shift and work with that to try and save money like business owners want to do.
Mr. Great. I kind of like to move on and get Josh Brown's testimony if we could at this point. He's been patiently waiting on the phone
for
15 minutes.
He might be appropriate for these.
Yeah, he would have a lot of these answers.
And
yeah.
I think he would weigh in on these conversations. So, Mr. Brown, if you're still with us, can you provide us with your testimony?
Absolutely. Good morning, Chair Holdy and members of the committee, and thank you for the opportunity for me to share my thoughts and experiences here this morning. Again, my name is Josh Brown. I am a franchise attorney with my own franchise-focused law practice located in Indianapolis, Indiana. I've been a practicing attorney for approximately 9 years, and through the course of representing many people in the franchise space, I've seen both the benefits and burdens of the franchise model. I've had the great fortune of helping many people work through the process of buying a franchise. I've assisted franchise owners, otherwise known as franchisees, in legal and business issues. I've helped individuals sell their franchises and worked with entrepreneurs to assist them through the process of turning their business into a franchise. So I've seen and worked with many in the franchise space, and not just from the franchisee perspective. Franchising in its purest form, in my opinion, is really a brilliant mechanism because it allows a business owner to build and grow a business through the use of other people's capital, while at the same time also providing a great opportunity for franchisees to buy into a proven system and model. When most people think about franchising, they first think of McDonald's and mostly think of fast food restaurants in general. But the realities of franchising, though, go much deeper and broader. They expand across just about every economic sector you can think of. It is a multi-billion dollar phenomenon that impacts many in every city, state, and town in America, including many in Oregon. Yet, as franchising has grown in size, number, and influence, so too have the constraints placed on the individuals that buy franchises. The vast majority of franchisees are individuals with one or two locations. These are people that invest their life savings, their retirement, or borrow money because they have a dream to run their own business, perhaps to pass a business on to their children. This is truly a part of the American dream. Yet more and more, I see daily occurrences where what should be a trusting relationship and operate almost like a partnership between a franchisor and a franchisee in a common endeavor to help each other grow and prosper, turns into a nightmare for franchisees. The legal documents associated with a franchise purchase are lengthy, verbose, and filled with legalese. Often, franchisors convey a message to their buyers that they should seek legal counsel, but that little can be changed in the agreement so as to maintain uniformity across the system. Territories which should always be protected are often not, which leads to significant encroachment issues and can make it virtually impossible for franchisees to sustain and grow their business. Often when I provide assistance to franchise buyers and franchisees, I'm educating them on things that they long ago should have known about their franchise, but they don't. Many franchise buyers have never owned a business before. They buy a franchise because they believe, whether right or wrong, that they are buying a business that has an established brand identity, proven systems, and the assistance, guidance, and support from the franchisor so that they can be in business for themselves but not by themselves. However, more and more franchise systems are doing a poor job of delivering on what they sell to the franchisee. They promise the world and deliver very little. Yet the franchise agreements do not provide for opt-outs in these situations. In fact, just the opposite. Most franchise documents specifically state that once the franchise fee is paid, it is non-refundable. Additionally, franchise agreements range from 5 years to 10 years to all the way up to 20 years in duration, with significant restrictive covenants that place handcuffs on those who try to get out of faulty or broken systems. These covenants prevent competition in often stifling ways in which many former franchisees go bankrupt or face the threat of bankruptcy before they are able to move on with their lives and businesses. franchising is not like a regular business. One significant difference is the way in which a failed franchisee is trapped or limited in what he or she can do post-termination or in the immediate aftermath of exiting a franchise system. To add to this already disparate situation, most franchisees cannot afford a legal battle with the franchisor. It is truly a David versus Goliath scenario, where right and wrong ultimately doesn't matter as much because the franchisor can significantly outspend the franchisees and spend them out of the litigation. Most don't even fight. And to add insult to injury, many franchise agreements contain one-way fee-shifting clauses, which allows the franchisor to recover its legal fees should it prevail, but does not extend the options should the franchisee prevail. This, of course, heightens the already risky, expensive, and emotionally tolling aspects of litigation. Now, we all know that franchising will never be an absolute level playing field. Nonetheless, there needs to be basic and practical protections that allow a franchisee a fair shot and provide franchisees with reasonable protections against less than honest franchisors. House Bill 3162, I think, provides an opportunity for Oregon to take the lead on this. Several states, including Oregon and Indiana, have franchise statutes. But this franchisee bill of rights is necessary to help further protect Oregon citizens that risk their capital, their life savings, and their retirement to help ensure that they get a fair shot at success. Now, I know nothing is ever guaranteed in life or business, but the pendulum, I believe, has swung too far the other way in the franchisee-franchisor context. Simple and common sense protection, like protecting a territory, a three-day right of rescission with the partial refund of a franchise fee, an opt-out clause if a franchise system materially and fundamentally changes its systems or brand, limitations on restrictive covenants, fairness in attorney fee provisions, rights of association among franchisees, prevention of discrimination against similarly situated franchisees, limitations against franchisors limiting a franchise right to litigate in their home state, and protections against a franchisor preventing a franchisee from selling and profiting from its business are all practical, logical, and nonpartisan ways in which franchisees can better be protected without negatively impacting the fundamental aspects that are a hallmark of the franchise model. Because of all this, I fully support House Bill 3162 and believe it is necessary to help better protect Oregon citizens and franchise owners. And, I think at this time I'd like to make a couple of comments. I know the International Franchise Association tendered some testimony and a letter against this proposal. And I think their opposition, at least as far as I read, really focuses on four different issues. One relating to suppliers, second relating to territory restrictions, the third relating to renewals, and a fourth relating to the restrictive covenant non-compete aspects of franchise agreements. I can say this for sure, that I don't believe those are issues that would have a negative impact at all on the franchise model. I know with respect to suppliers, and you guys touched upon this a bit earlier, in Indiana, there is a statute, the part of the franchise statute, that does restrict the franchisor from requiring a franchisee to buy its goods, supplies, inventories, or services exclusively from the franchisor if there is a comparable good that is of the same or similar quality. Now, this is limited if the franchisor manufactures or has a trademark on what they're selling, then they're allowed to require that. But absent of that, if a franchisee is able to find a similar good or service of the same quality that is pre-approved by the franchisor, they absolutely have a right to purchase that. And there is no negative impact on the franchise. There is not a negative impact on standardization because, again, the franchisor has the opportunity to approve that purchase. I think in terms of territory restrictions, the encroachment issue, I think it's an ever-pressing issue in franchising that people are sold territories and the type of definitions that are utilized within the franchise agreements are hard to understand and they have allowed the franchisors have been including provisions that subsequently allow them to eat away at people's territories, which is commonly known as encroachment. And this is a huge issue in franchising. And I think protecting franchisees from that is just a basic protection for their investment. I think with respect to renewals and with respect to non-compete aspects, I mean, I have seen firsthand where you have people who buy into a system, and even if they've had a good ride with the franchise, and let's say their 10-year agreement is up and they don't want to renew, they're still subject to a post-term restrictive covenant, which usually limits their ability to compete, and the franchisor tries to keep that as broad as possible. I know Indiana has legislation that requires it to be no longer than 3 years in duration for a non-compete, and to be no broader than the geographic limitations of the franchisee's territories. I know somebody had commented earlier about limiting litigation and about franchisees being able to litigate within their home state. Indiana's franchise statute contains a specific provision that calls for that and actually does not allow for the franchisor to limit the franchisee's ability to litigate in any fashion. So it is not only acceptable to do it, but it is being done in other states. And I think it's a fair and practical protection for a franchisee. Again, as Representative Fagan said, I do not believe that this bill is trying to upend the franchise relationship. We all know, or anybody who's been around franchising knows, that it's an unequal playing field. It always will be. You know, the franchisor, the person who originally built the business and now has decided to grow it, the true entrepreneur who's done that, certainly is going to have that advantage. But yet on the other side, when they're selling a brand, when they're selling a system, when they're selling a process, I think it's basic fairness to be able to ensure that brand, system, and process is what they say it is. And if it's not, that there's an opportunity for the franchisee not to be stuck, potentially harmed forever, but as a way to potentially get out of the system. So with that, again, I fully support this bill, and I believe it is necessary to help better protect Oregon citizens and franchise owners. And I thank you again for allowing me the opportunity to testify here this morning. I'd be happy to answer any questions from anybody.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Questions from the committee for Mr. Brown? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you had mentioned that there are becoming more and more franchisors that I think are taking advantage of their franchisees. And I was wondering where this is a business relationship that should be a win-win relationship. And for the franchisor, you know, to be successful, he would need the franchisee to also be working along with them. And I was wondering if there are some bad apples out there that stand out more than others, and if the majority of franchisers are doing a good job, and if there is needed legislation to just take care of a few.
Well, I think more and more the franchise model has become over the years attractive. I think the numbers prove that out for a lot of would-be franchisors. What I have seen from my own experience is that there are many, many franchise systems that have developed over recent years and continue to develop where they don't actually have a good enough system down to be able to be a good, viable franchisor. And so what happens is the best kind of franchisors, to what you said, I completely agree, is when it's more they're working together, right? The franchisor is providing the assistance to help the franchisee sell more, and that will naturally increase the royalty stream coming back up the chain to the franchisor. But what I'm seeing more and more of is heightened franchise fees at the outset, which let me just take a minute to explain this because I think there's confusion on this. Oftentimes people think of franchise fee as the entire fee associated with a franchise purchase. That's really not the case. Every franchisor or most of the franchisors have an initial franchisee where it may be 20,000, 30,000, 35,000, you know, sometimes 50,000 or more, just for the right to have the opportunity to use the brand, to use the system, and to expand. That doesn't include, if you're buying a retail franchise, that doesn't include the expense to build out the franchise and all other fees associated, training fees, marketing fees. And certainly doesn't include royalties that are that you have to pay on an ongoing basis. And so the typical retail franchise can cost upwards of $200,000 to $250,000 when all fees are said and done. Now, traditionally in franchising, the franchise fee is not as high, and the franchisors are more focused on providing a good system so that the royalty stream continues, and that's their incentive to provide a good system and to assist franchisees on an ongoing basis. What I've seen more of lately are franchisors that are in such a rush to grow that they're essentially charging higher upfront fees. They can't support it on the back end. And so really they're not making their money or the bulk of their money off of royalties. They're really making the bulk of their money off of the upfront franchise fees. And the way they make more and more fees is by selling more and more systems. And quite often, these people are really good salespeople, and they hire really good salespeople. But again, to your point, to make the system fully function, you have to have the back end support. So I don't know the breakdown on the percentages, but I think you would be surprised that it's more than you think, the number of franchise systems out there that are increasingly trying to grow at a pace faster than they can sustain. But at the end of the day, it's the franchisees that bear the brunt of that.
Just follow up.
Are there statistics out there available so that we would have an educated information to base, you know, our thought processes on, so that you know, we're just not saying there's a lot of franchisors out there that are, you know, getting a lot of money up front, but also just statistics to show how many succeed, how many fail, and how many franchisees do well.
Well, that's again a very hotly contested topic in the franchise space in terms of success and failure rate. That commonly online and elsewhere, you'll see a statistic that, you know, 90%+ of franchises succeed. I mean, that's just absolutely false. It's not true. And if you really step back from it, it's really not even possible. I mean, to think that 90% of franchisees succeed. Part of the issue with that statistic and some of the statistics in general that have been proposed and almost have become commonplace in terms of what people rely upon is that they're not exactly accurate, but they're not exactly inaccurate. So in other words, with the statistic, the 90% statistic, one of the things that statistic does not include is franchises that are resells. In other words, a lot of times people buy a franchise and they may not have success, or they may not have, oftentimes they may not have enough capital to get them up over the burden, you know, for the first 6 to 9 months. And so they get out of it by selling it to somebody else. Well, of course, they lose their investment, they have to sell it at a loss, and for all intents and purposes, that's a failed venture. But those aren't included in the statistics, aren't included in the categories of failures. Now, on the flip side of that, oftentimes people will buy a franchise and sell it, and they will make money, and it will be successful. So it's a difficult thing to categorize. You know, I think that when it's all said and done, if you look at the statistics, and there are different, I could certainly, you know, get some of those statistics over to you, but again, it depends on the source and who you're looking at. But I think this ultimate success of franchising is on par with the ultimate success of any small business. You know, you have an added advantage with a good system, a good brand identity, and good support. But there are so many franchise systems out there that I really think the percentages fall within the same level of any business.
Mr. Chair, can I add just quickly? So, I mean, to your point, Representative Barreto, you know, success or failure in the sense of whether the business stays in business, to me, is one question, but even for those that quote-unquote succeed because they stay in business, at what cost? I mean, the people, you know, there are a few. Oregon Elmers is one that's an actual franchisor that's in Oregon. But the vast majority of these, the franchisees are the Oregonians. They're the Oregon small business owners. And to what, you know, to what expense are they, you know, their franchises succeeding? Like, I mean, living on razor-thin margins, not being able to, you know, even when they want to, maybe pay better wages to their employees and give a living wage, being unable to because the margins are so thin, and they themselves not being able to have, you know, kind of a, you know, robust lifestyle as well. So I think that, you know, it's not just success or failure in terms of what goes out of business, but is there, you know, things in this bill that we could do to actually make Oregon small business owners more successful, you know, in sense of, you know, not going out of business or not, but actually, you know, being more profitable in their businesses? Because, you know, obviously that's what we want for Oregonians. I'd love, you know, with something like this, we would be the, you know, the greatest state, I think, in which to be a franchisee, in which to, you know, to be these small business owners in Oregon. So,
Representative Nose.
Yes, Mr. Brown, my question is, what? Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, what is the average profit margin, or what is the profit margin that can be expected for these, the people that buy a franchise? You know, if they're successful under these systems, what is the margin that their business might make?
Well, it all depends on the system. I mean, as I alluded to earlier, franchising runs across our entire economy. So, you know, with that question, it'd be akin to saying, you know, what's the average profit margin of any small business? Well, it really depends on the business. It depends on, are you operating, you know, a senior care facility? Are you offering a fast food restaurant? Are you offering a quick service restaurant? Are you operating a home-based business? A lot of it not only depends on the type of business, it depends on the structure of the business, it depends on who your customers is. So it's really, that's really an impossible question to accurately answer. I think, you know, you can go through sectors of franchising and sometimes figure that out. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but I think generally what most people or most smart people do when they buy a franchise is they figure out themselves, or they figure out who their representation is, as they look through what's called a franchise disclosure document. So every single franchise prior to purchasing a franchise under federal law has to be provided with a franchise disclosure document, which contains 23 mandated items, okay? And really, that's a description of the franchise and provides a lot of history of the franchise. Sometimes provides financial representation via item 19, which is financial disclosures. However, there's a lot of controversy around those because a lot of franchisors, when they provide those representations, make it appear as though it's a representation over a whole system, when in fact it's really a small representation over a certain number of the franchisees. So again, as with most things, the devil's in the details, and you got to really look at the fine print. But I think for the most part, when franchisees, at least in my experience, when they're buying a business, certainly one of the things I cover with them, and I work with their accountants and other representatives on, is when you're going to make this investment in the business, when do you hope to get that back? And when do you hope to really start profiting? And doing an analysis of that. But again, that all depends on the business that you're operating. And I think to Representative Fagan's point is that these kind of adjustments to the Oregon Franchise Act, in my opinion, are just really basic common sense adjustments. Like, there are, I mean, I'm dealing with a franchise litigation case right now that's against a very, very large franchisor, and there is a one-way fee-shifting arrangement where if the franchisor wins, they get all their attorney fees. If we win, we don't. And it's a very, very expensive proposition. Equaling that playing field from that perspective, again, it seems like a common sense thing that is not partisan in any way. It's just more fair across the board.
Thank you, Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brown, just a couple quick questions.
It's very interesting.
What states have actually, if this was said before and I missed it, I apologize, what states have actually passed, not pursuing, but have passed similar legislation?
Well, I think last I checked, there was about 15 states that had their own state franchise statutes. Again, Indiana being one of them. There are, let's see, we've got, I've actually got a list here. Let me see. Arkansas, California, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Maryland, Michigan, let's see, Nebraska, New Jersey, New York, North Dakota, Oregon, Rhode Island, South Dakota, Virginia, Washington, and Wisconsin are the ones that I've seen. But every state is a little bit different. I was telling Representative Spigen, in Indiana, when you come in, if you sell a franchise to somebody here, you have to actually register it with the Securities Division of the Secretary of State. So you go through an entire registration process. Now, there's a couple of exemptions for that, but for the most part, franchisors that come into Indiana have to register the franchise. I don't believe that's a requirement in Oregon. I don't think there's a registration piece to it. And so, really, there's a lot of states with franchise statutes, but some states have more teeth to their statutes than others.
My quick follow-up was, I heard you mention Oregon. Obviously, we haven't passed the legislation we're looking at right now. I'm wanting to know if there's one or two specifically that have similarities already in their state laws to what we're looking at and talking about today.
Well, I think that Indiana has certain similarities, especially with respect to limiting litigation, right? So, I mean, Indiana, again, as I think I said earlier, doesn't allow for a franchise agreement to limit litigation. I think with respect to discriminating against similarly situated franchisees, Indiana has protections for that. I think that, let me see here. I know in reviewing this, there were other aspects of it that I know Indiana has codified as protections, but there were certainly, you know, as an example, I don't know of a state that has an opt-out provision, even though I think that there should be almost like a 3-day right of rescission, because again, people put down large investments, and it's almost similar to in the real estate market, where you have, you know, the 3-day right of rescission on any type of investment, but Indiana does not have that included in it. And there are certainly other parts of this bill that are not included in Indiana law, but that's the best one. Indiana is probably the best state I can speak to.
All right, thank you.
For that practice here.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Josh, I'm kind of curious here because franchises have been around a long time, and I know there's places you can see which franchises fail the most and things like that. And I'm just trying to figure out how Oregon making kind of a bill of rights law would do ourselves any good, because we're such a small player in the market industry. Would not some franchisers or franchisees consider possibly pulling out of the state and just not want to locate here if we did this, if they have a good system in place? Could this actually cause franchisors to say, you know what, we're going to work in every state but Oregon because they're only 1% of the market?
I don't think so. I've not experienced that. And again, the type of protections that I think are being advocated here are not protections that are going to fundamentally upend the business or the standardization process. Nobody's, I think, disputing the fact that a franchisor has to have the ability to operate its business, and it's actually selling its own standards. I think that, as with most things in business, it's market-driven. And I think if my experience with franchisors is they look to expand in markets in which they think their business is going to have the best opportunity for success. And I think Oregon may or may not be the place for certain franchisors, but my experience is the decision is going to be based off of market factors and not off of legal factors such as these kind of statutes.
May I follow up?
follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point is, Josh, though, if, say, we had somebody who wanted to be a franchisee here in the state of Oregon, they reach out to some of these places, they might say no to them just because we passed this franchisee Bill of Rights here in Oregon that it appears no other state has. And they might tell them no. Could that could we create that scenario? That's what I was getting at.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to comment on that because there's nothing to base that off of. I don't necessarily see that happening. Again, I think the vast majority of good franchise systems, and I know sometimes with these kind of discussions it can be painted as a franchisor versus franchisees. It's not always like that, and I think the best franchisors would actually appreciate the fact that their franchisees are better protected and would appreciate the fact that there are more that is more fair from certain basic perceptions and levels. So certainly, could that possibly happen because Oregon would be the first of its kind? Absolutely. I mean, it could happen. There's a lot of things that could happen. I don't necessarily believe that it would happen.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Brown. We're going to move on with some others to testify. You're welcome to stay on the line if you would like to listen, or you can disembark if you wish as well.
Thank you. I'll be happy to stay on the line and listen.
All right. Next up, I'd like to call Bill Perry, Jerry Scott, and Betsy Earls.
Representative Fagan, just a question about her amendment. Thank you. The Dash 2s, do they eliminate the task force then?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yeah, the task force was purely just a placeholder.
I see. Okay.
Good morning.
Hey. Chairman Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry, Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association. I appreciate the discussion today. I was just going to say and give kind of a few examples of what I would call the smaller franchisees in Oregon and kind of why I think this bill doesn't necessarily help them per se. When you look at franchisees like Dairy Queen, Subway, Figaro's, which is also based in Oregon, and Quiznos, they tend to be only a couple of establishments, two or three on average. You'll have some, but a lot of them are kind of one or two offs. And so they're very, very small businesses. And when you look at a small business, if somebody wants to just open up a sandwich shop, they're in essence what I call, they're just buying themselves a job at that point in time. They're spending 60 hours a week. They're not making much money. You've got your food purveyor coming in the back door. You have no ability to negotiate, you know, your credit card fees. You don't do enough volume or carry enough balance to be able to negotiate. So there's a lot of these things that are happening that small operator really doesn't have any power to negotiate. A lot of those guys come to our organization because we offer that service, but the franchisee or the franchisor is really the best person to offer that service. That's the benefit. If you're just trying to open up a sandwich shop in a strip mall, they do the market analysis for you, pick your locations. They do a lot of different things that gives that guy that's just a small business an edge on the industry and the advertising know-how of how to reach a market instead of just the newspaper guy coming in the door, the radio guy coming in the door. They tell you basically which ones are the best revenues, or they purchase them for you. Now, those independent operators may not have the bargaining unit of somebody's got 15 units. And so what happens in Oregon is those guys have a franchise association. So Subway has a franchise association, Dairy Queen does. So then they basically select a group of people then that negotiates with the franchisor. So, I mean, that's how those smaller guys use the franchise agreement to try to negotiate these deals. And I would say the important part of this whole is leverage. Any important aspect of negotiations is leverage. And when you're looking at the restaurant company, they're going to have a better ability to negotiate credit card rates, insurance rates, food rates, equipment. They help you get deductions on your equipment by a couple of different things. Obviously, market share is one of them. If you have so many units that you're negotiating, you can get yourself a better price. Okay. Also, length of the contract is important. So if I guarantee you I've got this many units for 10 years, you're going to have a better ability to negotiate a price than you would this many units for 1 year. Because once again, it's all about recouping your original investment. And you know, the providers and the restaurant company both want that. And remember, if, like I said in the beginning, my brother went through to try to get one of the oil shops a while ago, and part of the thing when he was going through it was they did the market analysis. They didn't just say open up in a Safeway mall. They tell you how much traffic's going to go through it and everything else. And so if you utilize them to find a location, they have basically use their expertise to get that location. So if somebody opts out immediately, you know, you're kind of using their expertise and then and walking away from it, even though you've still got kind of the expertise. So I mean, there's a lot of different aspects that go into this, but really the negotiating, the marketing, the insurance rates, the credit card processing, and the food companies is something that's provided to some of these small operators. They're just never going to be able to get on their own, and so they use this pretty effectively. So with that, I'd pass it down and answer questions. I'll wait.
I'm going to go through the panel first.
Okay.
Thank you. Vice Chair Barton, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to address the committee concerning HB 3162. I'm Jerry Scott. I'm president and CEO of Elmer's Restaurants, Inc. Elmer's is a family dining restaurant chain that began in Portland in 1960. We're still headquartered in Portland and operate or franchise 25 restaurants, primarily in Oregon. Specifically, we have two company-owned and 15 franchise restaurants, all locally owned and operated in the state of Oregon. And while I appreciate that HB 3162 is well-intentioned, it is indeed a broad solution to specific individual isolated problems. Federal law already heavily regulates the relationship between franchisor and franchisee. There are numerous disclosures involved in the process of offering a franchise, and the time and manner of that information is exactly prescribed by federal law. Waiting times are built in to this process. The penalties for ignoring or violating the disclosure rules are significant. There are no surprises in the process. There is no need for additional parties to insert themselves in the contract. This bill will have a chilling effect on franchising. Two things ultimately will happen. In some cases, franchisors may not want to franchise in the state of Oregon under such conditions. Additionally, the cost of administering and offering the franchise will increase dramatically, so the royalties and fees charged by the franchisor, ultimately paid by the franchisee, may also increase for future franchisees. This may tend to limit the number of future small businesses opened in the state of Oregon. Now, granted, there will always be the occasional case where a franchisor acts in an arbitrary and capricious manner, and the existing law is quite capable of addressing those instances. There is no shortage of franchise attorneys. Franchising is the best way for an entrepreneur to open a proven business. Passing HB 3162 will make the opportunities for future small business owners both rarer and more expensive. That cannot be good for the state of Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing in opposition to House Bill 3162. I echo the testimony of my colleagues up here this morning, but did want to point out to you sort of the breadth of what franchisors and franchisees cover in this state and others, and make it clear that it's not solely a restaurant problem or a restaurant relationship. There are all kinds of businesses that are franchisors and franchisees, and those include, you know, of course, restaurants, but also hotels and fitness studios or, you know, gyms, shipping stores, auto parts and auto servicing companies, janitorial services, things like that. And these are all small businesses and franchisors across the state that are really providing a lot of the backbone of small business in Oregon. It's our position that the field of franchisor and franchisee law is already heavily regulated, heavily litigated, and you know, fairly well settled in most instances or in most of the concerns that are addressed by the bill. And we would just suggest that you think carefully about advancing a bill like this that could have a chilling effect on new franchisors and franchisee relationships in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Fagan.
Thank you very much. I certainly hope the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association also reached out to the franchisees in your organization to find out, not with the bill as filed, because that was different, but on the dash one, because I find it hard to believe that that there would be any franchisees who'd be interested in some of these protections. Specifically, Mr. Perry, you mentioned the benefit of associations. One part of this bill provides that a franchisors cannot prohibit franchisees from creating, joining, or participating in an association because, again, that's and I agree there is that huge benefit, but if a franchisor did not want the franchisee to have that benefit, as does happen sometimes, they can prohibit that in the contract. This Bill of Rights says no, they can't because exactly of the benefit that you spoke to. And you also talked about they do all this market research and they get that's and the franchisees pay for that. It's not like this is like goodwill that they're going to give you all this information. They're selling their service, obviously. I mean, there's just other provisions in here that I just the idea that this would have a chilling effect, I think, speaks more about your perception of franchisors than it does about franchisees, because the franchisors wouldn't come here because they had to deal this fairly with Oregon small business owners, then I would find that to be very disappointing. Again, I don't see the benefit to Oregon small businesses of having an allowance of forum selection clauses. It says, yeah, you may be a business owner in Oregon, lived in Oregon your whole life, but if you litigate, you have to go to Illinois. So this bill would say, hey, look, if you're doing business in Oregon with an Oregon small business, you have to litigate here in Oregon. I don't see how that could possibly have a negative effect on an Oregon small business owner to say, whew, I don't have to fly to Illinois. And finally, the fee-shifting provision to say that you can't have, as Mr. Brown testified, that he's currently litigating, because these do happen, that he's currently litigating a franchise agreement that just says, oh, if the big guy wins, you pay all our fees. If the little guy wins, you pay your own fees. And I don't see how it could possibly be to not benefit Oregon small business owners to be able to have that protection in place. So I certainly appreciate that Elmer's is a good franchisor. And again, many of these are pulled from the best franchise agreements as kind of things that they're doing right and putting them in as kind of a floor for Oregon small businesses. So that's just my thoughts.
No, and Representative Fagan, Chair Holvey, I appreciate it. And I would say, we've been on record before. I'm a big fan of loser pays. I mean, I understand this is one way. So if I'd just say from that standpoint, we have on our governmental affairs committee, we have 8 representatives that are franchisors, franchisees. Elmer's is one of them, franchisor. We have one that's a combination of both and 6 franchisees. And they all basically said that they fear that this is going to hurt the future of franchising in Oregon if it passes as is, just because the amount of restrictions that are out there. So, I mean, we did bring it up, and those are the direct ones involved. As far as the provisions on the law and this law, our understanding is Indiana is the only one that basically has the provision of the opt-out, and it hasn't been tested in court yet. And I'm not saying I think it'll pass. There's 2 attorneys on this committee that could have a guess. Obviously, it was the first question that popped into Representative Barton's mind. I think that's going to be a question that gets tested, and we'll see what the outcome is. But once again, you have a choice as a restaurateur to be an independent or a franchisee. And several people do not want to be part of a bigger association. We don't have everybody in our membership. The question is that once you become or buy into that process, which they are buying into it, I completely agree. They're by paying your fees, you're opting into market research, all these different things that will happen. If you don't want to go that route, don't go that route. But it's kind of like when you enter into that route and then you say, well, all of a sudden you gave me all the information, I don't want to, you can opt out. I think it's just a fundamental question that is hard to answer, because most, I would say a vast majority, over 90% of these are good cooperative relationships. And so, yeah, there are a few percentage, but is that, then the question is how much damage by protecting those few do you do to the majority? And it's an unknown because nobody's done this before. But you are saying there's a few examples where these people want to opt out after they've gone through the relationship. And I would just say that they probably should have been an independent at the time, at the beginning. I mean, it's just a fundamental question.
Other questions? Representative Nose?
No, I changed my mind.
You're done? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I guess I'll close this to the franchisor. So even though I know most of your business is here, but you were hitting on the federal litigation. And to me, that makes more sense to look at this federally because a lot of these are national chains that are going on. Do you think it would affect if we were to pass some of this legislation and you knew some of your members could opt out of buying the baking that you used for whatever? There's proprietary things that Elmer's has. So, and to know that one of your franchisees could say, you know what, I want to use this over here, it's the same quality, would that affect you or make you probably want to look at not doing a franchise here in Oregon at that point and going to states where you had more control over the quality and your name brand that you're marketing and pushing?
Thank you for the question, Chair Holvey, Representative Widener. The answer is simply yes. The franchising is really only two things you offer, but they're big things. The systems and the marks of the trademarks. In our case, Elmer's Restaurants, Elmer's Breakfast, Lunch, Dinner, various and sundry, we have the trademarks, Northwest Lodge, Blend Coffee, for instance. The other big portion of that is a system, which has to do with the way the operation runs. In our case, it's a restaurant, and the quality standards are extremely high in Elmer's. I'm proud to say we maintain the highest quality standards of any, as high as anybody else in the business, and part of the way you do that is specifying products that have to be used. You hit upon the pancake mix, and that's one of them. Allowing certainly anybody to use whatever pancake mix they desire simply makes it an issue of, all we're buying at that point is just the name. And we certainly would not franchise anyone who wanted to use their own quality standards.
Thank you. Looking at it, I don't think quality standards was at issue in the amendment that I saw anyway. It's a big amendment, and I really appreciate you coming in and offering us, your perspective on this bill as well. So I don't see any other questions at this time. Hope you have a great week.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 3162? Not seeing any. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3162. Anything else for good of the order, Jan? Much. We'll see you on Wednesday. With that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
Which amendments are yours?
By the dashed.
Which amendments are yours?
By the dashed.
On Business and Labor.